Morning, council. This is the case of Weaver versus Weaver. And we will begin today by introducing the court and then welcoming both council individually. My name is Mike Havikin and I'm the Chief Justice, and good morning again to you. By order of seniority on the court, the other members of the court will now introduce themselves.
Good morning. This is Lindsay Miller Lerman.
Uh-oh. Justice Castle, I don't think we could hear you.
William Castle, good morning. Thanks for catching.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Jeff Funk, good morning.
Jonathan Papik.
And John Friedenberg.
And counsel, is Ms. Flynn here this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
Good morning to you. And Ms. Albers, are you here this morning?
I think you're muted, Ms. Albers.
I think that is correct, Ms. Albers. Something that happens to all of us.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, good morning.
Good morning to you. Council, do either of you have questions before we begin the WebEx arguments?
No questions.
I do not.
Thank you very much, Ms. Flynn. You may proceed.
Your Honor, court, may it please the court. I am Stephanie Flynn, and I represent Lieutenant Colonel Glenn Weaver. Lieutenant Colonel Weaver respectfully requests that the Supreme Court hold the Court of Appeals decision, which reversed the trial court's decision. The trial court found that it would be in the minor child's best interest, Bravery's best interest, for Lieutenant Colonel Glenn Weaver to have additional parenting time. That's all that was needed to modify this decree. The Court of Appeals found that the trial court erred when it did not modify the decree based on the best interest of Bravery. The first assignment of error alleged by Ms. Weaver is that the Court of Appeals erred in finding that a modification could be granted solely based on best interest without a change in circumstances. The literal meaning has to be given to a decree. Rice versus Webb determined that. If a decree is unambiguous, then the language must be followed. This decree is unambiguous.
Sorry, Chief, I'm sorry to interrupt. Do we want to let the petitioner go first?
Well, good point. I was just looking at my sign-in sheet here. This is indeed a PFR, and perhaps we should start all over again and have you go first, Ms. Albers, and then you will also have a chance for rebuttal because you're appealing from the Court of Appeals, and my apologies to everybody for that. And Ms. Flynn, thank you for your argument thus far. We won't subtract from your ultimate argument for that. And thank you, Justice Papik, for refreshing my memory here. Ms. Albers, you may proceed.
Thank you. I think there's really two primary parts to my argument. First, the question I think is, can parties be allowed by stipulation to modify a longstanding legal precedent of this court that governs how the best interest of the child is addressed during a modification? And my assertion is it's not. It goes beyond the types of stipulations that a court would consider. And I note that the variety of stipulations and the different weight that are given by the two recent cases from this court, Yeager versus Yeager, addressing the best interest of the child, and the Goffin case, I believe it is, from last Friday, looking at a modification of alimony. Both of those cases address with a great deal of specificity the legal precedent of how these modifications are handled. And it's my assertion that parties should not be allowed to stipulate to modify them in the context of the best interest of a child. And the two recent cases, I think, illustrate the differences between cases looking at the best interest and cases looking at alimony. The second part of my argument is there really is no stipulation here. There is an ambiguous and vague statement within the contents of the parenting plan portion of the decree of dissolution involving the Weavers, but that does not rise to an enforceable stipulation.
Doesn't paragraph 4.2 of the settlement agreement, and that's basically part of the main crux of the Court of Appeals reasoning, didn't that actually go to the require participation in dispute resolution?
It does. And 4.2, it says parents are going to discuss between themselves a possible modification of the child. If the discussion fails, then you proceed to paragraph 4.4, which in the first step says go to mediation and work with the mediator. And if that fails, you can go to litigation, at which point the case is going to be dissolved by a court of the then current jurisdiction by that court's legal precedent. So this,
is it your argument that is ambiguous, or is it, do you believe the Court of Appeals was just clearly wrong?
I think the Court of Appeals was clearly wrong. They stopped at paragraph 4.2 and they did not read all the way through paragraph 4.4, which was a three-part step of discuss between yourselves. And that's where the sentence that everybody is clinging to is found. And then when you get to 4.4, you're talking about mediation and you're talking about what happens when you ultimately go to litigation.
On paragraph 4.2, the first sentence talks about it says upon a material and significant change in circumstance or in the needs or interests of Bravery, either party may request a modification to the physical custody of Bravery. Do you read request as a request to the other party rather than a request to a court?
I read it as a request to the other party. If you read it another way and go into saying that the or in that sentence is so important, then you have to read the whole sentence. And at that point, the whole argument collapses because you're saying, okay, well, we can modify the custody plan on this child's interest, or we can modify it based on a material change in circumstances. And that's not defined as, you know, unanticipated by the court at the time of the entry of the decree. It's just a material change. So if you really give that sentence its literal meaning, a parent could come in and say, something material has changed in my life. It has nothing to do with the best interest of my child, but I want a custody change. So, I mean, really literally reading that sentence, you reach a pretty absurd result. And you strip the trial court of its discretion to review the modification matter, which, as the Yeager court just pointed out, the first step you're asking, is there a material change in circumstance? That question is important. These parents mediated or agreed to a parenting plan, or a trial court found that parenting plan to be in the best interest of the child. Parents signed off on it, trial court signed off on it. And now one of the parents is coming in and saying, I want to change it. Well, isn't
counsel,
that parenting plan still in the kid's best interest if there has not been a material change?
Counsel, to what extent does the law of the District of Columbia and the Full Faith and Credit Clause an impact on this appeal?
I don't think it has an impact. The Full Faith and Credit Clause cases cited by the Court of Appeals and the Wyoming Court are those cases dealing with the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Act, the Support Act, and the Parental Kidnapping Act. And those are designed to say when you have an originating order from a state, all other states are going to enforce that order until this state acquires jurisdiction under one of those acts. And we now have jurisdiction to modify. We enforce using the full faith and credit according to the original state's laws and what the order says. But once the case comes to us and it's a Nebraska case and we're here at the request of the parties to modify it, we're using Nebraska law.
Counsel, what? I'm sorry for interrupting. Were you finished?
No, please go ahead.
If you weren't finished, I'd like you to finish before I ask my question.
No, I think I finished the full faith and credit issue.
Okay. So Nebraska has a statute that pertains to property settlement agreements and dissolutions as they govern matters of custody and child support. So what impact does 42-366 sub 7 have on your argument? That statute, that subdivision, provides that except for terms concerning the custody or support of minor children, the decree may expressly preclude or limit modification of terms set forth in the decree. What impact does that statute have on your argument?
I read that on Friday and I thought, I have to tell you, Your Honor, it really made me think, because it sounds like 42-367 is saying the decree may expressly preclude or limit modification of terms in the decree except as to custody or support of minor children. In this case, it almost seems like the Weavers were expanding it, but not really.
They weren't limiting it. They were actually saying you can modify for anything, anytime it seems right, like a good idea.
And that seems like it's still encompassed under 42-366-7, because I think the point of that subsection was you can modify or you can express how a decree can be modified, but not as to the custody or the best interest of a child. And that's what the Weavers did. And I think, as I read the Groffin case and stumbled across subsection 7, which I wish I'd seen before, I think it precludes what the Weavers did.
For the sake of argument, let's assume we agree with your arguments regarding the legal standards and the settlement agreement, and we move to the original issues that the Court of Appeals was reviewing. I'd like to get your response. To be successful in a child custody modification proceeding, is there a requirement to prove that the material change in circumstances was unforeseeable? If so, where is that established?
Well, I think that's established in case law, and it's been long standing. And I know the court recently clarified as to whether the material change was unanticipated by the parties as opposed to the trial court. And the standard is unanticipated by the trial court. I get back.
What case was that? And was that a child custody proceeding?
That was a child custody. Was it? I don't want to definitively answer that. I thought it was a child custody proceeding, that it was unanticipated by the trial court at the time of the original decree. And I think in the Yeager case, they're discussing that, in Kelly versus Kelly from the Court of Appeals also addressed that recently. But even though we're in family law, and even though custody and child support are always subject to review and modification, there is still an element of res judicata, and that when people enter into a parenting plan, they're entering into a judgment that is as final as possible. And people like the Weavers will anticipate known changes that are going to happen. The move from DC to Omaha, the fact that the little girl is getting older and the dad was building up his ability to exercise longer periods of parenting time that he had not exercised at birth. And they had a stepped up parenting plan that addressed that. They could have kept going. They didn't. They stopped at a point where Lieutenant Colonel Weaver was comfortable with, this is the parenting schedule I'm going to follow. And it was just a matter of months before he was back in asking for 50-50 time. I think he could have anticipated that his daughter was going to get older and all of the changes that he alleged in his complaint would happen. And I do want to note that Lieutenant Colonel Weaver only asked for joint physical custody in his pleadings. And it was his posture at trial court to ask for joint physical custody. He never asked for additional time or additional visitation as an alternative method of relief. And he stood on his request for joint physical custody. I think I'm out of time. I'm having a hard time seeing my screen.
I think you are out of time.
Okay, I apologize for going over.
Thank you very much. Back to you, then, Ms. Flynn.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I indicated, Lieutenant Colonel Glenn Weaver is requesting that the Court of Appeals decision be upheld. Ms. Albers argues that there's really no stipulation that can be enforced here. There is an enforceable stipulation, and it should be enforced. As indicated in the Walters case, stipulations should be enforced so long as they are not contrary to good order or the proceeding standards.
The question, stipulation, I think, I beg your pardon, I think the question has been become, is it enforceable if it is arguably contrary to Nebraska statutes and precedent?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily contradictory to Nebraska standards and precedents. We always have to look to the best interest of the child. This stipulation clearly provides that. And I believe that Ms. Albers' argument that somebody could change the decree just based on a change of interest does not comply with Nebraska laws or statutes. The Nebraska custody law statute that specifically governs custody doesn't require a change in circumstance. It only requires that we look to the best interest of the child. That's what this agreement is doing. We're simply enforcing an agreement. It's been held time and time again in Nebraska that agreements can be enforced, and they should be enforced if they're unambiguous.
Well, I think before we get to enforceability, I think there's an argument as to whether there's a stipulation at all. I'd like to hear your response to Ms. Albers' argument that 4.2 only discusses a request of a change in custody between the parties and doesn't speak to a request to change custody to a court.
Well, I don't believe it's accurate. I think it's clear that the agreement initially determined that they would work together and try to seek a modification upon an agreement. That's Nebraska case law too, that parties are supposed to attend mediation and try to reach an agreement. But the request to modify is based on a request to the court. I think that's clear that that's the request that's being anticipated.
Doesn't most of 4.2 speak to discussions between the parties? And then only the last sentence says, if they're unable to agree, go to 4.4. And 4.4 talks about a request to the court. Isn't that correct?
4.4 does talk about a request to the court, but I think 4.2 is also anticipating that it would be a request to the court. Even if the parties agreed to modify the custody agreement, in order for it to be enforceable, they'd still have to make that request to the court. So a request to the other party alone just doesn't make sense. They would still need to go to court and modify their agreement for it to be enforceable. Other states have recognized that there can be a change in custody absent a material change in circumstances. Wyoming is the big one that was discussed in the Court of Appeals opinion, but Iowa and South Dakota have also made similar rulings. The Wyoming Supreme Court in the Gerstein case found that the California order that contained a provision allowing modification without a change in circumstances should be upheld and enforced. Partially, they talked about full faith and credit, but they also indicated that the significance of that provision was clear to the court, and therefore it should be enforced, and the modification could be based on best interest alone. In the Wyoming Gerstein case, it's similar to this case in that the provision itself was not specifically argued at the trial level. However, the Supreme Court found that while it was concerning that it wasn't argued at the trial level, since the provision was clear, that the courts could go ahead and modify based on the provisions in the agreement.
I assume for the moment that this court disagrees with your point or your argument that Nebraska law would permit parties to stipulate to modifications without a material change. So assume we disagree with that proposition. Is there something about the law of the District of Columbia that would enable a different result?
Your Honor, I didn't specifically look to the District of Columbia. I was looking to other courts within our circuit and our jurisdiction. As I mentioned, a number of them allow that. I would have to assume without knowing for sure that the District of Columbia would allow this, given that it was in their agreement. But as indicated, we have to look to Nebraska law now. That's set forth in the parties' agreement, paragraph 4.4. And Nebraska law has held that the court will uphold stipulations of the parties, even if it's not something that would normally be ordered otherwise.
Have we ever upheld a stipulation to permit modifications without a material change?
The Court of Appeals has, but the Supreme Court has not yet decided the issue. The court has determined, though, that agreements to modify, for example, support for children can be, they can go longer than what the court would normally otherwise order. Our rules clearly indicate that a court cannot order parents to be responsible for their children past the age of majority, but if the parties agree to do so, then that stipulation will be upheld. Parties quite often agree that they'll pay child support longer or they'll pay for children's college education. Those agreements have been upheld over and over. This is no different. We're simply enforcing the agreement and the contract reached between the parties.
Ms. Flynn, working off the same assumption that Justice Castle asked you to work from, that we disagree with this argument and we move back to the original issues raised before the Court of Appeal from the District Court. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked your opponent. Is there law that establishes that the material change has to be unforeseeable before you can move to the best interest of child component of in a child custody modification proceeding?
Your Honor, I believe there is law that talks about unforeseeable events and circumstances. However, not everything here was foreseeable. There were certain things that were foreseeable as far as the parties contemplated that they would both likely be moving, but there's still other changes.
What would be some of the unforeseeable circumstances?
Some of the unforeseeable circumstances were the difficulties that Lieutenant Colonel Gwynweaver had with additional parenting time. It's clear in the plan that it was anticipated there would be more parenting time than the strict limits of the plan. But that rarely, if ever, happened based on the record in the trial court level.
To the extent that we have some tension or some ambiguity or something to that effect with respect to 4.2 and 4.4, how does this work in real life? Is it a fair reading of a stipulation or an agreement or a thingy, whatever this thingy is, that the parents would be encouraged to settle on a new regime without going to court? Would that enhance the dynamic post-divorce?
Well, I think group parties...
I beg your pardon, if they can do so peaceably.
I believe that parties routinely do this. Parties often reach agreements that a court may not otherwise order, but if they agree, typically the trial courts will go ahead and uphold that agreement. In my experience, it's a rare circumstance where a trial court would not uphold the party's agreement, especially when it comes to the children, if the parties indicate that they believe that the agreement is in the children's best interest. Ms. Albers argued that an individual could go to the court and seek a modification just based on best interest. I'm sorry, seek a modification just based on a change in circumstances without a showing of best interest if this agreement is read in its entirety. It's simply inaccurate. Nebraska law clearly still indicates by statute that we have to look to the best interest of the child. The best interest is always going to be looked at. Whether there's a change in circumstance or not, there still needs to be a determination of best interest of the child. That's always been the primary consideration, and that's set forth time and time again in case law.
What do we do if we believe that the stipulation is ambiguous as to whether it eliminated the requirement to prove a material change in circumstances?
Well, as I indicated, I don't believe it's ambiguous. I think it's clear, but if the court were to find that it was ambiguous, then the court, I believe, would have to use its discretion to determine what the agreement of the parties actually was. I think it's clear, though, that the parties anticipated that there would not necessarily have to be a change in circumstances if it would be in Bravery's best interest to modify parenting time, which the trial court found that it would be in Bravery's best interest for Lieutenant Colonel Glenn Weaver to have additional parenting time. I see that I'm out of time. And with that, thank you. And we would respectfully request that the Court of Appeals decision be upheld.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. So that concludes arguments in Weaver versus Weaver. Counsel, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
And you are excused.